Athletic.
Hello, I'm Ian McIntosh, and welcome to the Football Manager Show by The Athletic, the podcast that's looking at Derby County and thinking, maybe that's actually worse than Sunderland. On the show today, continuing our how do you play yours sort of vibe, we've got Tifo's Alex Stewart in to discuss Moneyball. What does it really mean, and how can you use it to maximum effect? We've got another position of the week with CJ Ramson, and this week it's the deep-lying playmaker, one of the most misunderstood positions in the game, mostly by me. We've got your letters too, but we've also got the start of a new feature, What Else Do You Play?, in which we ask our guests, what else do you play? It's a pretty simple sort of concept, and I'll go first, purely because I want to justify all the many hours I've spent on Crusader Kings 3. Anyway, let's get started. Alex Stewart from Tifo, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you here. We've spoken so many times over the past 30-odd episodes about the Bundesliga and, mostly about the Bundesliga. But today, completely different thing, because we're chatting to people who play Football Manager about the way they play Football Manager. And, you know, sometimes you want to lay down a challenge and some parameters, and it was... It hurts to say this, but I think nearly 10 years ago that you wrote a blog about playing strictly, very, very strictly, to Moneyball rules. I have seen Moneyball explained as so many different things over the years, often by football clubs and often completely wrong. Can we just myth bust quickly and talk about what isn't Moneyball?
Right. What it isn't, in simple terms, is just the idea that you use data in football. It's kind of become a shorthand for that. So any club that does anything remotely smart involving numbers is said to be taking a Moneyball approach. And in some ways it's more complicated, and in other ways it's simpler than that. The essential premise of Moneyball, going right back to the Michael Lewis book and Billy Beane, is the idea that you use data to find undervalued talent in the market. And that's the crucial premise, is why pay £20 million for a striker when you can pay 10? If they're going to be as good as each other.
This was the thing I remember with Liverpool when they paid 35 million for Andy Carroll and 20 million for Stuart Downing. And they said it was a Moneyball process because they had been through the data and Downing crossed the ball a lot and Andy Carroll headed the ball a lot. They vis-a-vis Moneyball. But we can be quite firm on this. Not Moneyball.
Not Moneyball, because I don't think anyone would necessarily say that Andy Carroll at 35 million represents astute value. I mean, the simplest way of looking at it in terms of football data is expected goals, which obviously is an addition to FM21 and will be part of 22, I'm sure, as well. If you have a striker who's scoring 5 goals from an XG of 10, then they're likely to be undervalued because their output is not matching their expected output. And so people will look at the absolute return, which is 5 goals, and go, they're not as good as someone who scored 10. But of course, if their expected goals is 10, it indicates that at some point their performance will improve substantially. And so you can potentially pick up a bargain along those lines. And that's, I mean, obviously that's a kind of layer of complexity that when I was first writing about Football Manager using Moneyball, I didn't have, because there wasn't expected goals. But that's the basic premise. I mean, what Billy Beane did was he realized that a couple of statistics in baseball that correlated very clearly to winning, including on-base percentage and slugging percentage, were not really regarded as particularly important, especially when set alongside the conventional wisdom, what they call the 5 tools of a baseball player, and also what they look like and stuff. And so he was able to build a team that cost considerably less than his rivals, but did just as well. And that's Moneyball.
Now, last night we got a message from Chelmsford_2021, who's a Football Manager player who he's set this account up in advance of the new game coming out, because that's who he's going to manage. And I love that, because Chelmsford is a team I used to watch when I was a kid and I wasn't allowed to get on the train and go to Southend on my own. He said, I don't believe Moneyball can ever be used properly in Football Manager. The board simply wouldn't understand what you're trying to achieve because they're hardwired to operate in a different way. And he said it's a shame because it would be a great way to play. Now, I totally see where he's coming from, but you've already done this and you've already succeeded. So tell me about your Rangers game, which was, I think, the first thing you ever got paid to write.
No, the first thing I got paid to write was the Bristol City one.
Of course it was.
The Rangers one was like the setup for that, I think. Yeah, Bristol City. And that was on the set pieces. In fact, you are responsible for me becoming a freelance initially and then like actually employed football writer. So well done, you.
I am the puppet master.
I'm sure some people don't look upon it so fondly. But yeah, so with that Bristol City save, I mean, the long and the short of it is that over 10 seasons, we had back-to-back promotions, established ourselves in the Premier League, and in season 9 of 10, won the Champions League. And I jumped ahead to episode 10 of that series, where I looked back. My net positive spend over the decade was 1.07 million, whereas Chelsea, their net spend was 463.45 million, and Man United's was 541.16 million. So basically, by spending 0.2% of what Chelsea did net, I won the Champions League, established myself as a Premier League side, and basically did all right.
Most of this was based on good scouting, presumably, not just who's got the best stats, but... Well, yes. No, I mean, a lot on the data coming through and the data that you deemed to be important. So what was that data and how can this be replicated?
So there were two key books that I read at about that time, Soconomics and The Numbers Game, and they're both absolutely great. I mean, they're slightly outdated now because of all of the advances that have been made in football over the last sort of 6, 7, 8 years, but still foundational texts. And I took a series of rules from that, things like net wage spend more closely correlating to winning than net transfer spend, when you sell players, when you should buy players, like don't buy players as soon as you join a club, don't buy players that are younger than 20 because you don't have a big enough data set. So aspects of this were quite moneyball. For example, Billy Beane famously doesn't sign high school players over college players because college players have got a more comprehensive data set because they're older. And it was basically kind of adhering to these rules as much as possible. Now, scouting obviously is a significant part of that. And so one of the things that I would look for is players who, and again, this was being done on a more basic version of FM. And so it would in some ways be easier to do it now. But I was looking for players who consistently performed well, but maybe weren't in a big league, maybe weren't getting international recognition, maybe were from somewhere unfashionable. So not Brazil or England or the Netherlands, but you know, maybe the Czech Republic or something. You know, it's that kind of approach of saying, maybe the easiest way to explain it is to say it's the opposite of what a lot of players do when they crack open Football Manager. They go, and this is no disrespect to them, but they go to a club with a big transfer budget and they go and buy all the players they've heard of who they know are really good and then try and work out how to make use of them. This was much more systematic in terms of looking at which consistent areas of my team are weaker. That's what I'm going to look at. So if everybody in my team is doing really well except for my right back, and I would work that out from where I was conceding my goals from and so on, I need to buy a right back. So all I'm looking at then is right backs that fit the template of what I want, who are consistently performing well, even if I haven't heard of them, even if they don't play in a sexy league, that's the guy who's going to do a good job for me consistently.
And this is a bit that a lot of people find counterintuitive, because often you can be playing and you think, God, if my striker could just put 10, 20% more of his shots on target, I'd be fine. Let's get a new striker. You want to glam up the big positions first. But a hard and fast rule throughout all of this was when you strengthened your weakest position.
Strengthen my weakest position and always put defence over attack. Yes, both of those things were crucial. So big purchases, I would be way, way happier to spend 20 million on a goalkeeper than I would on a striker, because actually over the course of a whole season, preventing goals correlates better to survival in the first instance than scoring goals. And I think as well, it's one of those things, you know, a striker's output obviously is measured in absolute terms of goals, but there's so much that goes towards that occurring that it may be nothing to do with your striker. It may be that actually your fullbacks aren't getting forwards enough. It may be that your creative midfielder isn't sufficiently creative. And again, the point here is how much money do you spend? So you're always going to pay more for a striker than you are for a defender or a midfielder, because that's the way that football thinks about things. You know, ultimately, the score is reflected by goals, and strikers get goals, so they're the most important. But if you think about it holistically, what you may be able to do is spend 20 million on two or three players that improve other areas of your team, and suddenly that you find your striker is actually doing really, really well because you've made those tweaks. You haven't gone out and spent that 20 million instead on one striker who ends up performing in exactly the same way.
The thing that I loved about this 10-episode series was that you had a very hard rule on when you had to sell players. Now, when I've got a player who's absolutely brilliant, you can prize him from my cold, dead hands. But you were willingly selling your best players at the point where you felt their market value was at its peak.
Yeah, exactly this. So generally speaking, there's two important aspects to this. The first is that if the AI offers you more than a player is worth, then you take it. That's partly because you never know what's going to happen to that player. They might get injured or something. But if the money's there, take it. But the second and even more important aspect of this is that you do that because you've already got somebody in line to take over. And so you're constantly, constantly scouting. You're constantly making notes about who's doing well, who's scoring, who's creating, all across the game, depending on how many leagues you've got. So that if you do sell that player who's maybe valued at 20 million and you sell them for 30, in your mind, either already in your squad or ready to be signed, you've got somebody who statistically looks like they'll be able to step up and replace that player for considerably less money. And that's how you keep the net spend down. And that's how you ensure that your team remains relatively strong from season to season.
Now, you watch an awful lot of football these days in your position at TIFO, making these incredible videos that you can find on YouTube. Would you say that Brentford are probably the best example of that Moneyball ethos that we've got in the UK right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think Liverpool, I know we disparage them for Andy Carroll and Stuart Downing, but you know,
they got there in the end, didn't they?
Yeah, like Firmino's a really good example of that. So they certainly set the pace, and people like Michael Edwards oversaw that. I think Brentford now are perhaps the best example of a holistic incorporation of data. So it's not just scouting, it's also the fact that they have a tactical statistician who sits on the bench and advises Thomas Frank during games. They obviously pay a lot of attention to metrics, and I don't know, because, you know, I'm not privy to these things, to what degree that influences the overall tactical composition of the playing style or what have you. But I'd be very surprised if there wasn't a lot of number crunching going on behind the scenes. So, you know, this is obviously because, and it was at Michelin as well, Matthew Benham made his money in gambling and using XG as a kind of tool of working out which matches had over or undervalued odds. And that was his edge. And he kind of took that thinking to football and has been extremely successful with it. So, yeah, I'd say Brentford are probably the best example.
So if they're the zenith of Moneyball in real football, where's the nadir?
Oh, gosh.
It's got to be Manchester United, really, hasn't it? Because they have this habit of just grasping for shiny things.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a good example with United. If you're looking at that concept of improving the weakest link of your team, United have consistently failed to do that because they still haven't signed a defensive midfielder. And at the other end of the pitch, they're spending vast amounts of money on, you know, excellent players. Jadon Sancho is a great player. Obviously, he's going to be a world beater. But if you keep loading up in one area of the team and you don't address your fragilities elsewhere, then ultimately it's not going to be as successful as it could be.
I mean, it is fun playing the game like this and having you literally had like 10 commandments of how to play. But when you're just playing for fun, or even when it's not fun and you're playing against me in the Bundesliga, which of these traits do you take with you and which do you leave behind?
The idea of strengthening weak areas just sort of gets ingrained. The idea of trying to line people up to take over if you have to accept an offer for someone. I suppose selling players, irrespective of how much you like them, is probably the aspect that I'm most comfortable shedding when I play the rest of the time, because you just don't want to get rid of Silas, do you? As anybody who's read the Bundesliga save will know. I became kind of infatuated with him. But a lot of the rest of it, it becomes second nature because it's also the way that I think about football more generally. And the kind of the journey that I've had into becoming a tactical analyst and playing Football Manager have very much run hand in hand. I got interested in tactics predominantly through playing Football Manager and reading Inverting the Pyramid. And the more I watched football, the more I thought about Football Manager, and the more I played Football Manager, the more I thought about football. So there's been a significant kind of impact on how I look at stuff, and that obviously feeds back into how I play the game.
FM22 is only about a month away. We've been asking everyone, what's your first save going to be, the first big game that you, the first big career that you go for?
Well, I always open up by having a go on Southampton because they're my team. That's usually just to kind of get to grips with any changes in gameplay and so on. I don't know. I quite fancy a kind of rebuilding project. I did a series for TIFO back when it was called UMAX with Livorno, who were in Serie C at the time. And kind of a bit like Southampton in some ways, you know, Port City and all the rest of it. And taking one of those Italian clubs that's fallen on hard times. I know this was very popular with Parma a few iterations of the game back. That would be fun. I also kind of want to see what I could maybe do with Stuttgart in the new game, because I've really grown fond of them and some of their players. So
yeah, wild horses wouldn't drag me back to Schalke. But that said, in the second division now, in real life, so maybe it is a challenge. Well,
Bundesliga 2 is absolutely replete with project teams. We did a video for TIFO recently on why should I care about Bundesliga 2, and you know, you've got Schalke and you've got Hamburg, but you've also got some really exciting tactical teams like Jahn Regensburg who aren't big hitters. So you could kind of pick any team in Bundesliga 2 and find a good reason for managing them. So that might be a good place to go.
And of course, when the game comes out, we'll be reconvening in cyberspace for our head-to-head multiplayer challenge. Have you given any thought to what kind of challenge would work this time? Because I'm actually thinking maybe we should give the Premier League a crack.
I was thinking the Premier League as well. Yeah, I mean, I think you either want to do maybe one of the kind of classic rivalries like Arsenal Spurs or something, but also, I don't know, there is a part of me that looks at someone like Brentford or possibly even Southampton, whose style of play I like, and see what I can do with one of those teams that already kind of thinks about football the way I do.
See, I can't do that because I think I'm taking over something that's working really well. The only thing I can do is screw it up. I was never able to be Southend manager for years when Steve Tilson was there. Oddly, I don't have that issue now.
No, weird that.
I'd rather walk into a disaster zone. So, yeah, again, Arsenal.
Yeah.
Natural choice. I just don't know what the better option is there right now. Alex Stewart, thank you so much for joining us. We'll find you on Twitter as AFH Stewart.
Yeah, that's right.
Excellent. And all over the TIFO as well. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
The Football Manager Show by The Athletic is brought to you by The Athletic. And because you listen to the show, and you're a bit of a face in these parts, you don't pay what other people pay. Oh, no. You get to visit theathletic.com/gaming, and you get it at a very special introductory rate. Now, that means pages and pages of the very best football writing, not to mention all of their other sports, ad-free podcasts, and, of course, Football Manager content like the aforementioned Me versus Alex Stewart FM22 Challenge. So visit theathletic.com/gaming right now before you forget.
The Football Manager Show. Position of the week.
It's position of the week, and as always, I'm joined by Sports Interactive CJ Ramson. How are you, CJ?
I'm good, thank you, Ian. Good to be back.
always a pleasure to have you here, especially for a position like deep-lying playmaker, because this is kind of a mythical position for British football fans of a certain age. This is Glenn Hoddle's position. Glenn Hoddle was the greatest footballer of his generation and only got 53 caps because no one knew what to do with him. We were used to a two-man midfield that basically had someone to kick lumps off people and someone to go box to box and get up and support everybody. Or, you know, occasionally you had someone who could do everything like Brian Robson. But a deep-lying playmaker, that was something we struggled a bit with. And the first thing, I guess, is that you can have one in the anchorman role or you can have one in a traditional midfield role. What's the difference between those two positions?
So the biggest difference for me is the role that you use it in and the duty you apply. So the defensive duty usually is best for the defensive midfield. You've got players like Busquets that will take the ball off the defence and kind of start the attack and move it into midfield and kind of just sit at a screen in front of the back four and be a playmaker from that position. Whereas if you play in the central midfield position, it's kind of better to use a support duty. So they don't drop quite as deep and they're still involved in the attack, but you don't have to go with, say, two box-to-box, or you don't have to go with a box-to-box and a number eight. The number six positions kind of come back into vogue at the moment, and I know you kind of touched on it not being historically an English position, but England played the 4-4-2 with a four and an eight, typically, like you said, a kind of destroyer. And a box-to-box midfielder, when a lot more European teams played with a deep-line playmaker in a midfield three, which is kind of where the number six role came from. So it's a really good one to use if you have a player with the right technical ability and a player with good passing. In the lower leagues, you might have a player who hasn't got incredible passing, but he's a standout for your team or a standout for the league, and that can still work just as well. But on a counterance to that, if you have a player who you're trying to use as a deep line playmaker and he just doesn't have the passing ability, then it can end up being a bit of a hindrance for your team and you'll notice yourself giving away possession more than you'd like to.
Is passing the key attribute for this role? And are there other ones like vision and creativity that are just as important?
Absolutely. I'd say it's probably one of the most important attributes out of any of the midfield roles, kind of passing for a deep line playmaker, but also positioning, because a lot of their role isn't about chasing the ball and winning it back. A lot of it is about being in the right position to cut off attacks, and also vision. Vision's probably my most important attribute personally, because I always want a team that can play expansive passing and find those runs. So vision, passing, positioning are the key ones for me.
It's a good one for people who aren't quick, isn't it? Because they don't have to run much.
Yeah, you can kind of protect them with runners around them. So I'd like to play a deep line playmaker defend, maybe at my base, and then a box-to-box midfielder with another midfield role that's maybe a bit more energetic, just so they have the legs around them. And we all kind of love signing an older player who's lost his pace but has kind of a place in our heart. So they're usually good ones to play in that role.
Is it dangerous to play a 4-4-2 with a deep line playmaker? Can you leave yourself exposed and able to be overrun in the middle like that?
A lot of it depends on the personnel. If you match them with a box-to-box playmaker who's got the legs and got the stamina and work great to cover him, then it will work fine. I mean, I've played it myself in the past. However, like I said, if you kind of use the wrong player in that role where they're not really retaining the ball and they're not looking after the ball as much as you'd want, you'll quickly notice a midfield two with the deep line playmaker just won't work.
And if you end up playing a deep line playmaker, an advanced playmaker and a wide playmaker, what happens? Because I did that by accident recently.
I saw you get told off for this as well. So historically, you've only wanted to play one playmaker role. In some of the presets like Tiki Taka, we have more than one, kind of to replicate what Pep Guardiola does, where you've got multiple playmaker roles in midfield. But especially with the deep line playmaker, your team will look to play into the playmaker. So all it kind of does is lowers the effectiveness of your deep line playmaker. Whereas you might want to go deep line playmaker, advanced playmaker, with your deep line playmaker being the one that starts the attacks. But you can change the advanced playmaker to, say, a box-to-box midfielder or a different midfield role which isn't a playmaker role, and you'll see more balls come through your playmaker.
One of the things we've talked about so often on this series is the importance of player traits and how often we overlook them. What are some of the key player traits to look out for and to avoid with a deep line playmaker?
So avoid, I wouldn't say there's too many, because most of the ones you wouldn't want just aren't already on the players unless you teach them yourselves. So maybe runs the ball through centre wouldn't be ideal if that's not how you're trying to play. A lot of the passing one tries killer balls often, tries long passes, those types of traits, they're usually my go-to. I remember I had, talking of a 4-4-2, and maybe FM18, I had a really good Bournemouth team and I played 4-4-2 with Lewis Cook, deep line playmaker defence, and I taught him tries killer balls often and he was just a joy to watch in that midfield.
CJ Ramson, that is perfect. Thank you very much.
Cheers, thank you.
The Football Manager Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
It's time for your letters and thank you so much for sending them in. You can write to us about anything, really. I mean, ideally questions about the game that we can send to Sports Interactive. But if you just want to tell us what you've been up to, that too is fine. imacintosh@theathletic.com is the email address. Or you can usually find me on Twitter, Ian_Games. Producer Steve, who have we got first?
First up is Matthew Cook, who's written in to say, I have deployed the same 4-2-3-1 tactic since time began, with two others trained but hardly used. So why do I still get the same message come up every now and then before a game saying that several key starters still aren't familiar with the match tactics? It seems weird that I don't change much tactically, and sometimes they love the tactic and sometimes not. Is it just a training thing or are my players just awkward?
Almost certainly players are just awkward. Footballers are awful. They're just awful. No, I mean, that would be my view, but you're not here to listen to my view. We got in touch with Sports Interactive and they said, look, familiarity isn't just based on formation. It's based on various factors, including specific instructions like directness and pressing, and role familiarity. How much have they played in that role recently? And this is key, are they training in the role that they're playing in on a match day? So I've done this on so many occasions where I've been using someone as like an advanced playmaker. And after a few weeks, I thought, nah, it's not going to work. Go deep line playmaker. And of course, for however long before you notice, they're sitting there training for a completely different role than the one you're asking them to play on a match day. So they say it's likely that they're changing a certain instruction within that tactic that's throwing them off the familiarity, or they're training their players in roles they're not being played in for matches. But generally, the pre-match briefing can cause a few concerns too. So maybe you're using a player in a role that they have conflicting, now the term here is PPMs, player preferred moves with, and we've talked about this before. So if you've got a deep-lying playmaker who you want to be playing sort of killer 50-yard balls, but he only likes playing short passes, then you're going to have a bit of a problem. If you've got someone who really likes taking people on, but you're telling him not to, you're going to have a problem. So once again, it's another example of everything in this game affecting everything. So hopefully that'll answer your question. And if you're listening to this, thinking, oh my God, I do that, I'm an idiot, I've been playing this game 30 years and I literally paid to present a show on it. And I frequently will go to the sections of training and I'll find that I'll have attacking midfielders on defensive training for some reason, again, because I've changed my mind about something and haven't remembered to go and tidy it all up. So go and have a look at that and I hope that helps.
So next up we have James Fawcett and he writes to say, so by we, he means Northern Ireland, have had issues with players from the North selecting the Republic of Ireland after playing for the North in international friendlies. The recent example he cites is Mark Sykes, the Oxford United player who had represented Northern Ireland up to under 21 level and who had been called up to the senior squad, recently declaring that he no longer wished to be considered for selection because he wanted to play for the Republic of Ireland instead. Now, there are lots of reasons why players can switch national sides, obviously. Crucially, they can do this before playing a competitive senior fixture. But in this case, one of the ways it can happen on the island of Ireland is because of the Good Friday Agreement, because an Irish passport can be held by individuals on either side of the border. But James's question is this wired into the Football Manager game, or is this so complex that they just don't entertain it? Now, what does Sport Interactive say to us there, Ian?
So we did some looking into this. Right now, it's not a factor in the game, but interestingly, it is logged as a feature to possibly be implemented in the future. Might not definitely be, but it is something that they're very aware of and they're keeping an eye on for future versions. So there we go. finally, I just wanted to read this. This one came in like an hour before we've sat down to record. So brilliant timing from Lewis Walker. He says, really enjoy the show. Love your enthusiasm for the game. Lewis, all I've got is enthusiasm. There's no talent. Enthusiasm fills the void. I recently started an unemployed save and ended up embarking on a Bundesliga adventure of my own by landing the Hertha Berlin job. After losing my opener to Leverkusen 1-0, I realised I had a group of players low on confidence and creating very little. Next game was at home to a really good Mönchengladbach side, and suddenly it's a must win. And so says Lewis, I decided the only thing for it was some Macintosh-endorsed spithousery.
Spithousery.
I managed with some halftime tweaking to sneak 1-0 in front and spent the remaining 35 minutes time-wasting, slowing the tempo of the game, setting my striker to a pressing forward defend duty and just generally doing everything I could to disrupt their rhythm and stop them from playing out the back. And it worked. I saw the game out without conceding even a single clear-cut chance and grabbed an absolutely crucial 3 points. When you're fighting relegation, you do everything you can. I love stuff like this. If you've only just discovered the show, it really is worth going back through a few of the old episodes, particularly ones on issues that you might not have focused too much time on, like set pieces and training. We've had so many messages about spithousery that sometimes, you know, the game has changed. A lot of us fell in love with it years and years and years ago and still want it to be the kind of thing that you can basically play on autopilot. You do have to adapt occasionally, and stuff like that really helps. Lewis says, Bayern at home next. Any tips from your Bundesliga challenge on how to stop them? No. always got beaten. Good luck. Yeah. That is your letters. Again, if you want to send us anything you like, it's imacintosh@theathletic.com or Twitter, Ian_games. So welcome to a brand new feature designed partly, I mean, you know, to tide us over until the release of FM22, but also to showcase great games that might appeal to you. Because you know what? You are not normal. You habitually play a game that requires intense concentration and attention to detail. You're not normal. You're better than normal. And you deserve the best. And so my recommendation, which will be no surprise to anyone who follows me on Twitter, is Crusader Kings 3. It's just an extraordinary game. It is part grand strategy, part RPG. It's a game that requires you to put as much energy into raising your kids as it does raising your armies. Now, if you've ever played a Paradox game before, like Hearts of Iron or Europa Universalis, you will know that they tend to be huge, barely penetrable masses of maps and numbers. But this one's different. It looks great. And it does still take a bit of practice. And you really should watch a couple of YouTube explainer vids just before settling in, you know, just while it's uploading or something. But it's pretty simple and intuitive. So you take on the role of a noble person, might be a count, might be a king, in either 867 AD or 1066. And that person has attributes and character traits, just like a new gen. You guide them through their lives and you make decisions. You have to have an heir. That bit is very important because when they snuff it, you become the heir. And so the game goes on. And these traits are really, really important. Because technically, you can make your character do anything. But if you make them act against their instincts, they'll be swallowed up by stress and gradually kind of fall apart. So, for example, if you've got a good and just and noble king, you can't go around murdering people because he won't be able to handle behaving like that. And if you've got a lusty character, you are going to need to get them laid a lot. But there are just so many ways to play. I've been Chief Ian McIntosh of the House McIntosh in Desmond, and my grandson Tony Hibbert McIntosh, eventually United Ireland. I'm currently playing the Alfred the Great scenario, where you have to beat off Vikings, in a manner of speaking. I've racked up hundreds of hours, and I haven't even tried playing yet as an African leader, an Indian leader, a Chinese leader, any of the innumerable possible starts. So it's fun. It's educational. It's a Paradox game, so it's basically going to get years of updates and DLC and get better and better and better. Now, it is a bit pricey right now. I generally play my games on Steam. It's £42 on there. Other outlets are available. I forever have used the £1 per hour measure of value. If a game costs £20 and I get 20 hours of fun out of it, That's money well spent. So I do feel it's worth it because I got hundreds of hours out of this. But, you know, you can always stick it on a wish list because every now and then you get an email just going, oh, price is down, dig in. So anyway, that's my game to tide you over, Crusader Kings 3. It's like Football Manager, but you can execute those who disappoint you. And that's our show. If you like it, review it, leave a link on Reddit that says, oh my God, have you heard this podcast? It's awesome. It changed my life. Or, you know, whatever feels right to you. Our guests today were Alex Stewart of the TIFO and CJ Ramson from Sports Interactive. Your producer was Steve Hankey, and I am Ian McIntosh of the House McIntosh, and I will see you next week.
The Athletic.